Midnight has passed, and in the stillness of these hours, the hauntings are never silent. This is Real Ghost Stories Online, After Midnight.
I don't know where else to start, so I'll begin with the first thing I ever saw that didn't have any rational explanation. The thing of fire that crawled out of a stove on a Christmas night in 1951. I was 4 years old, small enough for the world to still feel oversized, and we were living in Renton, Washington. The house had one of those old pot-bellied stoves that everyone used in those days. It sat in the living room like a blunt, breathing anchor. Orange. Warm. The kind of heat that smells of coal and old metal. It was the middle of the night. I woke up and padded down the dark hall to use the bathroom. The house was quiet except for the soft pop and sigh of the stove. Everything else in the living room was swallowed by the dark. Then something bright flashed at the corner of my eye and my whole world narrowed to that single light. I turned toward the stove, and I don't have any adult-sounding metaphor that'll make this easier. A being of actual flame, about 3 or 4 feet tall, leapt out of the iron mouth of the stove and started dancing across the floor. It had a body of fire and 2 red eyes like coals. It moved like a person who knows they don't belong here. Graceful, deliberate, and furious. I remember the smell of things burning, and then the hot metallic tang of fear. I ran. I don't remember the steps, only that I ran straight to my parents' bed, crying and soaked with fear and apparently something else because I wet myself. My mother woke immediately. My father rolled over and went back to sleep as if the world hadn't just opened and tilted. My mother dragged me under the covers and tried to calm me. I told her what I'd seen, and she was quiet in a way that scared me more than the thing that had leapt from the stove. I stayed in her bed for the rest of the night, folded under her arm like some small animal she couldn't make safe. I never saw anything like that again. Not the same thing. Not the same certainty that there are layers to this world we don't touch. Years later, there would be other things. Strangers in the dark, a house that had a will of its own, things that moved and knocked and walked when no one walked. But that first night with the fire being is where my sense of a different world started. It felt older than me, older than our family, like something that had been waiting for the right house, the right night to make itself known. We moved west, California, when I was a kid, and in 1956, my parents rented a wooden stucco Spanish-style house in Inglewood, a neighborhood of the Lenox area that still smelled of orange groves and gasoline from the airport runway not far off. That house at 10,130 Condon Avenue was built in 1920. It was the sort of home with long shadows and a creak for every step. It had a small yard, a detached garage, and a lean-to shed that my brothers and I used for everything a neighborhood kid uses a shed for. Hiding, playing, getting into trouble. All 4 of us kids, I was 9 then, slept in 1 room. Army surplus bunk beds lined up along the walls, the mattress slung on wooden slats that hummed at night. At first, the house felt like any other of that era. Drafty, a little dim. The kind of place that stores summer warmth in its walls and gives it back late at night. But the first time the odd noises started, it was unmistakable, scratching like nails on wood under my bed. It began as a sound and then it moved. Fingernails across the slats, then a scrape behind the headboard, then a knock in the wall, then impossibly under my younger brother's bed on the other side of the room. The noise had rhythm, intent. It wasn't the house settling or pipes complaining. Each scratch traveled the room as if someone was choosing a place, a child's bed, and saying, "Here!" We were terrified. My younger brothers cried. The scratching wasn't constant, but it happened frequently enough to make us dread bedtime the way you dread a storm. Sometimes the scratching came with knocks, hard, deliberate raps that answered our small, frightened whispers. Those first nights taught me how small the world could become, how big your fear can get when whatever is making the noise refuses to be seen. In 1957, we started hearing footsteps, but not the kind of footsteps you expect. These were slow, scraping swish, swish on the hardwood, like an old person shuffling along the floor with slippers that never lifted. They moved across rooms, down hallways, around corners, always after 10 at night when the family had gone to bed. The sound would pass close to our room, and we'd all hold our breath. Sometimes the footsteps stopped directly outside our door and then continued down the hall as if the person inside had changed their mind. One night stands out and has stayed with me my whole life. We'd all been in bed, the night light gently burning, because after the phenomena started, my parents insisted on it, a small mercy of glow to keep the dark from feeling total. The scratching started under my bed, then under my brother's. There was a knock on the window between our beds, a sound that made Snowball, our cat, spring up and arch her back, hissing. The footsteps began in the dining room, slithered into the hall, and then, impossibly, into our bedroom. The door was closed, but I watched it open slowly as if an invisible hand had turned the knob. The silence was full of motion. Snowball hissed again and flattened herself against the footboard, eyes like two coins. Something struck the foot of the bed with a clang so loud I felt it in my teeth. I hid under the covers like a child who knew better but couldn't help herself. My mother told me later she had heard the footsteps from their bedroom. She believed then, though I don't think any of us had the vocabulary for what we were experiencing, other than haunted. Dad came down that night, the light switched on, and for the first time I heard my father, practical, rational, North American aviation engineer, say, "I don't know why this house is doing this." Then he gathered the ball from the top of the hall shelf and carried it back to bed. The house fell quiet, like someone had told a secret and asked to be believed. What followed was a string of things that piled on each other until you stopped trying to make sense and started learning to survive. One evening, a basketball, abandoned on a top shelf in a hall closet, rolled free and began to bounce down the hallway as if someone were dribbling it. It hit the floor at a steady 3-foot rhythm, made a sound like distant music, then stopped when my father flung open his door and snatched it as if he could catch the trick midair. He told us to sleep, and for that night we managed to. Another night, the cat would lead us in parades to where small items had been rearranged. Cups moved across the table, pens that leapt a foot and embedded in the plaster near my face. A glass tipped over in the kitchen while my mother worked, and the water ran into the sink with no human hand to push it. Then in April of 1958, the thing we had feared and not named finally showed itself to me and my brother at the same time. We were playing after school, racing around the lean-to shed behind the garage, chasing one another in that silly, fearless way boys do. We ducked in and out, chasing, laughing. When we rounded the door of the lean-to, we saw her, a tall, thin, wrinkled woman in a white lace wedding dress standing inside the shed, looking out through shabby curtains at us. She wasn't a shadow. She had a face, narrow, lined, cold, and somehow familiar. We ran screaming. My brother still says his legs wouldn't go fast enough. Later, a relative of the house's previous owners came by to clear out a trunk. He opened an old steamer trunk in front of us, and inside, folded neat as a moth in a box, was a white lace wedding dress. He told us the trunk had come from Mrs. Dillon, the old woman who had lived and died in that house not long before we moved in. She died of pneumonia in November 1955, they said, upstairs in a back bedroom. He showed us a photograph, an elderly woman, with the same stern eyes we'd seen in the shed. The dress apparently had been stored and never worn again. Standing there with my brother in the doorway, watching the trunk opened, I felt something like a confirmation and a chill. We had seen her. After that, the activity didn't let up. Walnuts, heavy black walnuts from the tree in the backyard, would appear in piles in my sister's room or roll down the wall and land as perfectly formed, unbroken spheres at the foot of her bed. They'd show up inexplicably on the floor or in the closet. The logic of the world seemed to shrink. Nothing was as where it should be anymore. My sister, who slept in the back room, started to tell us that in the night, she felt something heavy pressing on her chest, something with a stink of rot and an exhausted breathing, as though someone had tried to smother the air out of her. She'd scream, and then the pressure would lift. More than once, she said she felt like she was drowning in her own bed. We'd run into the room and find her sitting up, eyes wide, hands shaking, swearing she couldn't breathe a moment ago. By 1959, the house had worn the 3 years as if it, too, had been tested. We moved that year to another place in the Lenox neighborhood, a larger, plainer ranch-style house built about 1910 with knotty pine in some rooms and higher ceilings, a roomier kitchen, and a pantry that made my mother breathless with delight. It felt promising and normal, a clean slate, but the ledger of odd things waited like something patient. The second house didn't start as dramatically as the first. It had charm and quirks, a big black walnut tree that dropped fat fruit with a loud thunk onto the roof and the yard in autumn, a laundry room that smelled of soap and metal, a pantry where I learned to steal cookies. For a while, it really did feel like a break. Then the walnuts began to behave strangely again. They'd fall on the roof, as usual. But the next morning, neat little piles of whole, unmarred walnuts would appear inside my sister's room. We'd find them on the floor in perfect groups, or balanced at the top of the wall, rolled slowly down like tiny planets choosing a path. There were no broken shells, no squirrel tracks, no explanation. It happened often enough that we stopped trying to beat a story out of it and started to catalog it like weather. The worst thing, though, was what happened to my sister in that house. She told us, and we all heard it, that on several occasions something came into her room at night, heavy and foul, pressing on her until she couldn't breathe. It smelled awful, she said, like old garbage and damp rot. She said it held her down as if it weighed 100 pounds, breathing loudly and slow. In the morning, she'd wake up exhausted and terrified with blotches on her face and fingernail marks on the sheets. We'd be pale and quiet until she said that it had stopped and for a few nights we could sleep. Sometimes the house would reach out in smaller, almost mocking ways. The covers pulled off the bed while I slept, leaving me chill and exposed. A toy rolled out from under a dresser and stopped at my toe as if to say, "I was here." The phenomena were relentless in their inventiveness. Then came the fire, the one that made the house stop feeling like a house. It was October 1959. Something caught in the garage behind the house. Old cords, rags, an oil-soaked rag. Nobody remembers how it started for sure. The garage burned down in the night. Firemen came with hoses and sirens and the smell of smoke that would not be scrubbed from the windows for weeks. The structure collapsed into a blackened skeleton. We stood on the lawn in our pajamas and watched the glow, the neighbors murmuring in the dark. After the fire, the faces began. At night, someone or something would stand outside at the windows and look in. At first, it was brief, a glimpse at the corner of a pane, but then it became bold. A face would press to the glass and glow in the streetlight like something turned inward. We saw strange, bony faces that were not quite human, eyes dark and staring, the features neither solid nor entirely there. Snowball would arch and stare under the windowsill, growling at the air. Children don't forget that kind of look because it steals sleep and replaces it with a wide, raw fear. After a year of this, at the end of 1960, my parents moved us again. We went to Norwalk, and the phenomena receded. The banging and footsteps and walnuts became memories like cold weather, sharp at first, then dulling with time. The houses were eventually torn down decades later and replaced by other things, a parking lot, another house. But the stories they held did not go with the planks and the nails. People told me later that new tenants there in the years after had tales too. When I went back as an adult to ask, an old neighbor said quietly that she lit candles there and had seen them blow out by themselves. She told me, "The house likes to be known. If you know how to listen, it will talk." I grew up in that house of scratches and footsteps and walnuts, and it bent the shape of my faith and fear. My father, an engineer at North American Aviation, was practical, but he never mocked us for being frightened. My mother, who kept the house and folded the laundry and tried to make sense of things, and kept a careful record in her mind, a ledger of all the nights she had to go and reassure children in the dark. We didn't have photos or tape recorders. We had a cat that hissed and a trunk that held a wedding dress. We had the sight of an old woman in lace and the sound of things moving by themselves. That's the evidence we carried. People have asked me in the years since what I think those things were. Ghosts, poltergeists, something attached to a person or a place. I don't pretend to have a single answer. There are stories in the old books about poltergeist activity centering on households with unsettled emotions, histories that repeat themselves like records. There are also stories, older still, about spirits who remain because they are tied to objects like a dress folded in a trunk or to rage or to death that was abrupt and lonely. What I know with the same clear certainty I felt when I looked into those red, burning eyes as a child is this. The world is layered. We move through places where other things have habit, memory, and grief. Sometimes those things show up with a laugh, sometimes with a knock, sometimes with a face against a window. Sometimes they press on the chest of someone who sleeps and make a child wake gasping. Those years, 1956 to 1960, taught me to pay attention in ways that children aren't taught. They taught me that ordinary houses keep extraordinary stories. They taught me that you can live with the feeling that the house is watching you and still learn to grow into a life that has a faith and a cause and a kitchen where you can make coffee in the morning. I don't ask for help now. I don't expect anyone to fix those years for me. I only tell what happened because someone once told me that stories keep their own kind of life. If you listen to this and you live in a house that creaks with memories, if walnuts appear on your floor for no reason, if you ever see a face against the glass in the blue of midnight, you're not the first to know that you live beside other things. We are not alone in the way we used to think we were. If there's one thing I hope you take away from this, it's that sometimes the strangest things are the ones that make you believe in a hand to hold or a light to follow. I saw a fire that danced out of a stove. I saw a woman in a wedding dress folded into a trunk. I learned to wake a neighbor and say, "Did you hear that?" and know that someone else might answer, "Yes." We keep memories like a light, and sometimes the light lets other things speak back.
Want more real ghost stories? Then press subscribe now so you don't miss any of the multiple new ghost stories we drop for you every day. Only here at Real Ghost Stories Online.